Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the results of primary elections in eight states yesterday, with close attention being paid to New Jersey and California for signs of a blue wave that could sweep away Republican control of the House in November. Ed Kilgore, the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist and a political columnist for New York Magazine, where his latest article is California Democrats Did Well But Not Perfectly in Primary, joins us to discuss the light turnout by Democrats who narrowly avoided being shut out of key House races. And in spite of Trump's unpopularity in the Golden State, there was a strong showing by Republicans. With a considerable number of mail-in ballots yet to be counted, we will analyze whether in a number of close races where a Democratic candidate in a crowded field of other Democratic hopefuls managed to slip into second place behind a Republican incumbent, the chances of a blue wave upset in November could be diminished. And since the margins between Democratic challengers in second and third places are so close, with 2.7 million mail-in ballots now being counted, we'll assess who might end up being the most viable Democratic candidates in the general, since some were chosen by the DCCC and others by the California Democratic Party. Then, with the opposition candidate Lopez Obrador polling over 50%, way ahead of other candidates, including the pre-party of outgoing President Peña Nieto, we will go to Mexico City to examine the latest twists in the tortured saga of the 43 missing students, which has gripped Mexico and led to Peña Nieto's downfall. John Gibler, the author of I Couldn't Even Imagine That They Would Kill Us, an oral history of the attacks against the students in Ayotzinapa, joins us to discuss how a Mexican federal court has ordered the government to investigate the 2014 disappearances again, this time under the supervision of a truth commission led by Mexico's National Commission for Human Rights, along with parents of the victims. This time, the court insists that for the first time, the role of the federal police and the army in the massacre and disappearances has to be investigated. Then finally, we will speak with David Phillips, a former senior advisor and foreign policy expert to the State Department under Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. He joins us to look into a major strategic blunder underway with Secretary of State Pompeo making a deal with Turkey to sell out the Kurds over the objections of Secretary of Defense Mattis. We will try to make sense of why Trump is letting ISIS off the hook just as it is about to be finished off and rewarding Turkey, Russia, and Iran against the national security interests of the United States. Joining us now is Ed Kilgore, a political columnist for New York Magazine, the managing editor of the Democratic Strategist and online forum. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and a federal state relations staffer for three governors of Georgia. His latest article at New York Magazine is California Democrats Did Well, But Not Perfectly in Primary. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ed Kilgore.
Thanks, Ian.
And I frankly am mystified, Ed, why Democrats aren't more motivated. I thought there was a real sense of outrage at Donald Trump and what he's doing. And in particular, since the Latino turnout was so poor, along with the Democratic turnout here in California, this key state that was supposed to be the leading edge of the blue wave that'll sweep the Republicans out of the House in November, the Latinos didn't show up, and yet you've got Latino children being ripped from the arms of their parents on the border by the Trump administration. Nothing could be more hideous. So what's going on?
Well, the low participation in primaries and in midterm elections among young and Latino voters is a very, very, very old story. It didn't just start, didn't just happen last year, didn't just happen the year before last. It's been true, really, basically since people started measuring these things, and there are pretty obvious, understandable reasons why young people are not terribly rooted in any given community. With Latinos, obviously, there are citizenship issues with some, and they, too, often have very mobile lifestyles. So, it's not like this just happened. And I think, California's top two primary is very confusing to an awful lot of voters. I mean, I live in California, and when I got my ballot with 32 U.S. Senate candidates, I wanted to just throw it in the trash myself. So I think now that we've gone through two midterm primaries under the top two system with just abysmal turnout, in 2014 it was the lowest in California history. Looks like it's going to be a little bit better this time, but not massively. I think it is time to ask whether the system itself is discouraging participation, because it just doesn't make sense to people.
You make in your article, Ed, you make the connection between the low turnout of Latinos for Kevin De Leon's pretty poor showing in a race where, of course, Senator Dianne Feinstein was way ahead. But for a while there, it didn't even look that Kevin De Leon would be in second place. And Antonio Villaraigosa, I think, what was it, $24 million was poured into his campaign by backers of charter schools, and he made a very, very poor showing.
Yeah, he wound up with, well, I don't know. Again, we need to preface all this by saying that the votes are still coming in. I think as of this morning, I heard one estimate that one-fourth of the vote was still out. Since California allows you to postmark a mail ballot on Election Day, and as long as it arrives in a county election office by Friday the 8th, it still gets counted. So there are a lot of votes still being counted. We need to keep pointing that out. But, you know, as of this morning, Villaraigosa was being beat 2-1 by John Cox, Donald Trump's candidate, which is not much what you expect to occur in California, particularly with Villaraigosa, a pretty well-known guy. I mean, he was mayor of Los Angeles for quite some time and was in the national spotlight. And, yes, he did benefit from massive spending. So, to me, that was one of the biggest surprises of the election night, not just that Villaraigosa didn't make the top two, but the margin was so huge.
So it was not just a bad night for Villaraigosa, but for Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, who put up millions of dollars, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So. They're, you know, the same people are also backing a candidate for the nonpartisan office of Superintendent of Public Instruction. It'll be that race will go to the general election in the fall. It'll be interesting to see if they put up that kind of money in that race for what's basically a symbolic office. But the war they're having with the teachers unions in California is, you know, beyond reason, clearly.
And again, I'm speaking with Ed Kilgore, political columnist for New York Magazine, the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum. And he was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and a federal state relations staffer for three governors of Georgia. And his latest article at New York Magazine is California Democrats Did Well, But Not Perfectly in Primary. Now, in terms of the enthusiasm gap, where I thought the enthusiasm would be all on the side of Democrats, it looks as if there was a considerable amount of enthusiasm on the side of Republicans, does it not? Particularly with the candidate for governor, who was endorsed by Trump, doing so well. Rohrabacher did well. A whole bunch of them did pretty well. And the incumbents did very well. Steve Knight did much better than people expected. So it makes me think maybe they're not so endangered.
Well, again, you got to keep two things in mind. One, we haven't seen all the votes. And I know some pretty smart people who think that the Democratic percentage of the vote is going to go up in these final mail ballots quite a bit because Democrats tend to be late deciders. The second thing is that the general electorate tends to be significantly more pro-democratic in California than the primary electorate. Ironically, part of the reason for that is that independents really don't like to participate in the top two primary, even though the whole thing was designed with them in mind. And in California, independents skew democratic. So, you know, yes, there was certainly not this sort of huge enthusiasm gap that we're used to seeing in special elections, but it may not. You know, overall, as of this morning, it looked like the voting pattern was 60-40 Democratic statewide. you know, with a lot of local variations. And if that goes up to like 63 or 64 by the time all the votes are counted, that's a pretty good advantage for Democrats, particularly when you consider that the electorate in November will be much larger and typically more diverse. I did note in my piece, though, that the Republicans have a couple tricks up their sleeves that will help with their voters. The most obvious is a gas tax repeal ballot initiative, which hasn't been certified yet, but almost certainly will be. And what's interesting is that that initiative was financed by basically by the California Republican Party and several individual campaigns, like Mimi Walters' campaign, but a ton of money in it, because they think that's going to be the big turnout generator for their vote, you know, particularly where in Orange County, where this whole backlash to the gas tax increase seems to have developed most, and where they just recalled a state senator, a Democrat from Orange County, was recalled yesterday. His only crime was, you know, voting for the gas tax increase. So that Republicans really do believe that that's going to juice up their vote significantly. And there's also going to be a ballot initiative to sort of to expand the Prop 13 tax benefit for homeowners over the age of 55. And I mean, as I observed at some other point today, they might have just called this, you know, the tax exemption for Republicans, considering where the benefits are going to be targeted. So, you know, those two things on the ballot in November will help Republicans offset at least some of the anti-Trump enthusiasm among Democrats.
But, Ed, how come the Democrats weren't able to use the incredibly powerful issue that the Republicans, in a petty and vindictive way, raised the taxes on California to punish this successful blue state by getting rid of the state and local tax deduction, which raised the taxes for everybody in California? You'd think that would be a winning issue.
Well, it probably will be. Again, this is a primary. In a lot of these primaries, Democrats were jockeying for position with each other and trying to achieve name identification. So you shouldn't have expected, and we didn't get, a highly substantive campaign. But I do think that will be a theme, you know, particularly in some of these higher income areas like Orange County, where losing that or capping the property tax or state income tax deduction and also limiting the home interest deduction, which the bill also did, is really going to hurt some people, a lot of people that normally vote Republican. So, yeah, I think we'll hear more about that between now and November. It's still a long way to go till November.
Well, let's talk about this wild card here with the mail-in ballots. 11 million mail-in ballots were sent out to registered voters. And there's about, what, 2.7 million have been returned, and they're being counted now. Right? Yeah. So that's quite a lot, given the numbers that we had. And in some of these races where you had Democrats coming in the second and third slots, or barely coming in at all behind a Republican incumbent, the numbers could switch, right, in a number of those races. And in the
It depends on how much stock you put in this theory that the late vote is usually more Democratic. I mean, last time I looked, there were no Democrats that were going to be locked out of a general election. There was a Democrat in every single district. There are actually, I think, 9 Republicans that are going to be locked out of Democratic general elections in Democratic districts. But you know, in the competitive races that people actually care about, at the moment, Democrats are not in any danger of a lockout, but it's just too close in a couple of districts to know for sure. Then you got this whole insane situation in Los Angeles County where apparently 118,000 registered voters were not on the voter rolls when they showed up, and, you know, were because of some printer glitch is what we've been told, and that they were asked to cast provisional ballots, which will be counted very late. And in addition, you don't know how many of those people just turned around and went home. In fact, I have speculated that that might have something to do with a really poor showing by De Leon and Villaraigosa, since both are from Los Angeles County, but, you know, we'll just have to see.
Well, but, for example, the race, the Rohrabacher race, and I thought he was very vulnerable. I mean, after all, Kevin McCarthy, the number two Republican in the House, likely to be the next speaker if the Republicans hold the House, said in a private conversation with Paul Ryan and other top Republicans, I swear to God, Donald Trump and Dana Rohrabacher are on Putin's payroll. I mean, this is a guy that should be incredibly vulnerable. The DCCC ran one candidate.
He didn't do very well either, did he?
I mean, no, but I was going to get to the fact that the DCCC ran somebody and the Democratic California Democratic Party ran another candidate, and they're very within a whisker of each other. So the mail-in ballot could change that dynamic, could it not? Who gets to run against Rohrabacher?
Yeah, I mean, the people I've talked to think that the gap between both of those candidates you mentioned and the second Republican, Scott Baugh, is probably going to increase. You know, we'll have to see. That was a really convoluted situation, though. You had a candidate backed by the National Party who was endorsed by the state party. Then allegations came out of he was a professor, came out of him, you know, supposedly sexually harassing students. That was investigated. He says it's a lie. The university says it's a lie. By then, the DCCC had shifted to another candidate. Just a, you know, kind of a perfect storm of mistakes. So I don't really know who to blame for that series. I mean, that sort of thing could happen almost anywhere. Again, if you had to have a culprit, it's the top two system that throws all these candidates in there together. But I mean, Rohrabacher is in deep trouble. Don't be mistaken about that. In fact, getting another Republican in there may have been the only thing that could have saved him. But I thought it was interesting that Donald Trump, of all these candidates in California, there are two that he congratulated publicly. One, which makes some sense, is John Cox, the gubernatorial candidate that he endorsed. But the other one was Dana Rohrabacher. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether it's because he thought the guy needed help or what it was, but, you know, I think Rohrabacher's, you know, in big, big trouble.
Well, maybe it's because they have a mutual friend in the Kremlin. But
yeah, well, that's the obvious joke, but you wouldn't think that Trump would want to draw attention to that,
right,
would you?
Well, just in closing, though, Ed, there was an expectation that about seven of these Republican seats would be picked up by the Democrats and flipped in November. As of now, has it gone down a bit, or do you still think there's seven?
No, I think it. I mean, you know, the Cook Political Report had, I think, five of those seats as either toss-ups or leaners, and two others likely Republican, which means, I think they had seven in the most competitive category and the two other likelies. So, you know, I don't think we should assume that because a district went for Hillary Clinton in 2016, though, they're going to necessarily go for a Democrat in a U.S. House race. All these people ran ahead of Trump, all these incumbents, in 2016. So I think, sure, it makes sense for Democrats to target all seven, and maybe a couple more will come into view, too. But, you know, I don't think anybody assumes that Democrats are going to sweep all seven or that they'll need to sweep all seven in order to take back the House. I mean, there are four marginal seats in New Jersey where primaries occurred yesterday. There are two more in Iowa where we had primaries yesterday. There are four or five in Pennsylvania. So, you know, whereas California is very important, I think we may be overstating it just a bit. Democrats don't have to win all of these targeted seats. But, you know, again, we have to wait and see what the final vote looks like to sort of see what we're contending with going into November. But, you know, I think Democrats have about the same chance of taking back the House than they did 24 hours ago.
Well, Ed Kilgore, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ed Kilgore, a political columnist for New York Magazine, the managing editor of the Democratic Strategist and Online Forum. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and a federal, state, relations staffer for three governors of Georgia. His latest article at New York Magazine is California Democrats did well, but not perfectly in primary. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing how a Mexican federal court has ordered the government to investigate the 2014 disappearances of 43 students again. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Mexico is John Gibler, who is the author of I Couldn't Even Imagine That They Would Kill Us, an oral history of the attacks against the students of Ayotzinapa, and Mexico Unconquered, Chronicles of Power and Revolt, and To Die in Mexico, Dispatches from Inside the Drug War. His work on the 43 missing students from Ayotzinapa Rural Teachers College has been published in California Sunday Magazine, featured on All Things Considered, and praised by The New Yorker. His latest book, Torn from the World, A Story of Forced Disappearance in Mexico, will be released this July. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Gibler.
Thanks very much for having me on the air.
Well, thank you for joining us. In this story I've been trying to follow, it's Byzantine and Machiavellian and convoluted, but now something rather extraordinary has happened, has it not, that the federal court in Mexico has ordered the government to investigate the 2014 disappearances of these four college students again, but this time under the supervision of a truth commission, which is to be led by the nation's top human rights body and the parents of the victims. So that in itself, apparently that's even caught the families of the victims by surprise.
Absolutely. I think this is a ruling that not a lot of people are anticipating, largely because it comes in response to appeals that were filed by a number of the people detained who denounced that they were tortured into signing false confessions. The families and their lawyers were both surprised, though happily so, by this ruling, which, as you said, completely invalidates the entire federal attorney general's investigation, sustaining the claims that it was largely produced through the generation of false confessions under torture, and that it contains gross omissions such as complete failure to investigate federal police participation as well as the role of the army in the attacks that night.
Well, the government nevertheless has been clinging to this absurd scenario that they developed, and they've never explained why these people that were tortured and coerced into confessing, these minor players, local cops and a minor drug ring in rural Mexico, that's always been extraordinary to try and get your head around, the idea that the best they could come up with was a dump somewhere outside of town where it would have been physically impossible to have incinerated all of those students because you wouldn't have had the heat to do so. So it's never made any sense. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which is a part of the OAS, they had a panel of lawyers, investigators, and human rights specialists look into this. But the government turned around and basically fired them or cut them off at the knees. And then we found out later that the Mexican government had these jurists and investigators under surveillance. So I don't think you have to be conspiratorial to wonder, what is it that the government is covering up?
Exactly. As you've just outlined, the federal government's role since the very night of the attacks has been one of lies, torture, the invention of a false crime scene and a false scenario to sustain the story, the absurd story that it started telling from the very beginning. So what could lead, really, the entire force of the executive branch of government to lie for almost 4 years now, 3.5 years, about what is arguably, although not an isolated event, but the most kind of shameful and politically explosive event, atrocity of the administration? Whom are they trying to protect? What are they trying to keep from being found?
So take us back to the actual event itself. It was something, and I hesitate to say routine, but the students often commandeered buses in their political protests. And the school has a kind of Marxist tradition, and I don't know who they angered, but take us through what happened in this town. And one of the things that's extraordinary is that there are, what, 6 killed at the time, 40 wounded, and none of the – there's been no accounting on any of that.
You're absolutely right. So that night, the students were, as you say, carrying out a somewhat routine, if not very common in the U.S., but for them, a somewhat routine political action, which is to commandeer commercial tour buses and use them for either getting to a protest or oftentimes as a part of their state-mandated education curriculum of traveling out into isolated regions of the state to observe elementary schools and the teachers in their classrooms. So they were going out to grab a few buses, the shortest version possible, because these are incredibly complex events. So the students were attacked over a series of about 9 hours, both inside the city of Iguala, as well as attacks that were carried out far outside the city. A youth soccer team was brutally, mortally attacked also by police out on the highway about 15 kilometers outside of Iguala that night. And these attacks were carried out by municipal police officers from 3 different municipalities, Iguala, Kokula, and Huituco, as well as Guerrero State investigative police officers, Policías Ministeriales, as well as uniformed federal police officers. All of these people openly participating, widely observed, widely documented, participating in these coordinated attacks. Another major element is the role of the Mexican Army. The Army has a very large base located right in the city of Iguala. In fact, it's only a mile away, as the crow flies, from one of the main scenes of attack against the students. And yet the soldiers did not appear uniformed in uniform on the streets until sometime about after 1 a.m., when they forcibly removed some students from a clinic where they'd gone to seek medical attention for a student who'd been shot in the mouth, medical attention that was denied to them there. And then the soldiers kind of posed in the shadows around the intersection where 2 students had been shot and killed, and were there when the reporters from the state capital of Chilpancingo arrived. Those are the reporters who have most of the connections with the international press agencies and took the photographs that night that would be those released on the wire and traveling around the world. So this wasn't a confusion. This wasn't anything like a routine confrontation between the openly left-wing students and the police. This was very much a coordinated military-style attack involving hundreds of people taking place over an extended period of time, over a complex and vast geographical area. So obviously an attack that had to have both a command structure and a lot of electronic communication going on, like cell phones and radio communication between the different police forces.
So again, I'm speaking with John Gibler, who is in Mexico. He is the author of I Couldn't Even Imagine That They Would Kill Us, an oral history of the attacks against the students at Ayotzinapa, and Mexico Unconquered, Chronicles of Power and Revolt, and To Die in Mexico, Dispatches from Inside the Drug War. His work on the 43 missing students from Ayotzinapa Rural Teachers College has been published in California Sunday Magazine, featured on All Things Considered and Praised by The New Yorker, and his latest book, Torn from the World, A Story of Forced Disappearance in Mexico, will be released this July. So just let me get this straight, though, John, just in terms of the actual casualties. And you got 43 disappeared. You got 6 killed at the actual incident itself. And I understand, was it 40 or 41 wounded? What happened to the 41 wounded? Are they a part of the disappeared number?
No. The student who was most critically wounded is Aldo Gutierrez, who was shot in the head and is in a vegetative state. He's still in a coma, alive, mm-hmm. only on life support, at a hospital here in Mexico City. Another student was very gravely wounded, shot in the mouth, and has been undergoing a series of reconstructive surgeries to try and repair the teeth and the bone, as well as the tissue that was all obliterated by the gun, the bullet wound. And then there are a number of students, as well as teachers and other people who had arrived after a first initial attack and were thus out in the street trying to help the students when they were attacked a second time at one of the main locations. And these are people who mostly received gunshot wounds to the arm, to the leg. A number of other students received gunshot wounds to the hand, to the arm. And most of those students have fully recovered. Or recovered. One student had lost several fingers with one of the gunshot wounds. But yeah, it's because of the intensity of forced disappearance, the nature of that violence, how it destroys families who can't return to their everyday lives or are forced to look for their missing sons. So much of the other impacts of the violence is often left out of the conversation, of memory, the fact that so many people were wounded that night, also people, passengers in taxis on the highway, both the trainers and the young soccer players and the soccer team that was attacked, where 3 people were killed at that scene of the attack, the bus driver, a 14-year-old soccer player, and a woman who was a passenger in a taxi that was driving by. Oftentimes that scale of the violence, those particular impacts of the violence are left out of the conversation. And then, of course, the very horrifying and brutal story of one of the students, Julio César Mondragón Fontes, who was not only tortured and murdered that night, but mutilated by his killers. They removed his face and eyes before discarding his body in a small pile of trash a few blocks away from one of the scenes of attack.
And on top of all of that, 43 of these students were disappeared.
43 students forcibly disappeared by police, uniformed police officers using their official police trucks to drive away with the students. All of that widely documented, in many cases even photographed with outside surveillance video footage, and yet they haven't been seen since. Instead, the federal government spent 3.5 years inventing a fake crime scene, as you said. And I think this is an important point, that within really a matter of hours of the federal government's announcement that these supposed perpetrators had confessed to having incinerated the students in this trash dump, it sounded strange and implausible, because people who know the area know that the trash dump is this vast open area, and then also that it rained all night that night. So it just seemed weird immediately. But the parents traveled out to Cocula the very next day, or within hours of that announcement, and analyzed the trash dump. These are people who live and work in those very mountains, and oftentimes use fire as a part of the cycles of subsistence agriculture. So they were there and saying, no, that a fire of that intensity would have burned all of these, all this other vegetation in the area, would have left these kinds of marks on the ground. I mean, they were really the first investigators were the mothers and fathers who went out there, and they were the first to say that this is impossible. But again, because they're campesinos, because they're rural people and not so-called scientists, their knowledge was never validated. Their knowledge was not taken seriously by the state. And now it's taken years and years and all of these different reports and international agencies and now courts to basically come up and say the same thing.
So in this federal court in Mexico that have ordered a new inquiry to be supervised by a truth commission to be set up and led by the nation's top human rights body, along with parents of the victims. In their report issuing this new call for another investigation 4 years later, they point out that there's no sign that the earlier investigations, and that included the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights investigation, which the government sabotaged and essentially ended, they weren't able to follow any leads involving the military and the federales. And the report today that's been announced setting up this new investigation said that there were no signs that any of these lines of investigations that showed possible participation of personnel from the Mexican army and the federal police were ever investigated. So let's focus on that. There's a military base in Iguala, about a mile from the scene of most of this atrocity. It also happens to have a huge incinerator that's capable of disappearing all of these bodies. What's your hunch on this? Because, again, I go back to, without being conspiratorial, if Peña Nieto's government and the Attorney General have gone to such lengths to come up with such ridiculous stories and they've clung to this in the face of international rebuke from the OAS and from now from the United Nations, nevertheless, they've stuck to this line. So they have to be covering up something that implicates the entire government. And my hunch would be that the military had to be involved.
I share that hunch. I share that hunch both because of the dynamics of the attacks that night and both what the military did and what they didn't do, where they were visibly, right, in uniform, in patrol trucks, and where they weren't. And because, as you say, and I agree, the absurd contortionism that the federal government has pathetically tried to use to divert attention away from the army. You know, here in Mexico, sometimes I'm invited to give journalism workshops, and one of the first things I tell young journalism students is, you know, whenever a major act of political violence takes place, you know, you try to locate and listen to two things immediately. One, of course, what do the survivors and the witnesses say? And two, what is the government's official position? What is, you know, whether it's through a statement or a press release or whatnot? Because almost always when the federal government says X happened, you know that it didn't happen. If they say in Notislan, Oaxaca, right, they say the federal police weren't armed, then you know that they were carrying guns, right? You know what you have to go investigate. You can't just assume, of course, as a journalist, but the initial government enunciation gives you a kind of indication of the work you need to do, the reviews and the interviews and the research you'll need to do to find what really happened. And here it's something similar, where from the very, very beginning, the government has done everything possible to say, don't look at the army, don't talk to the army, don't ask any questions about the army, which leads me, and I think many other people, including, as you've mentioned, the independent investigators that were hired in agreement between the families, the Mexican government, and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, all said, we need to be interviewing the army. We absolutely have to speak to the soldiers on duty that night, interview all of them, review the 27th Battalion Army base in Iguala. The parents had been protesting outside of that army base for years. And I think you're absolutely right that the court's recent ruling explicitly points to the blatant refusal on behalf of the federal government to let anyone else investigate the Army or talk to anyone from the Army, and their refusal to do so themselves, of course.
Well, just in the last minute, if you could wrap it up, because this is ultimately the important question, John, at least I think so. The government's never explained what possible motives there were for doing this, for murdering all these kids, shooting recklessly at bystanders and killing young 14-year-old soccer players and bus drivers, and then disappearing 43 of these students. So if it was the Army, what was their motive?
Of course, we don't know yet, but I think we have enough evidence, and this was the, you know, the hypothesis of the Independent Commission, referred to as the GIEI, was the possibility of the students having unknowingly commandeered a bus that was refitted and loaded with a heroin shipment bound for the United States. That possibly could have set off the kinds of attacks that we saw, where they begin with just the police trying to stop the students. And then once they've stopped them, then, you know, different scenes, they do different things. Some of the students, they disappear them, all of them. Some of them, they let them walk away. Some of them, they shoot at them. And a part of that chaos, as well as the intense escalation of the violence, the night gets bloodier and bloodier as it progresses from, say, 9:30 all the way past 1 in the morning, could correspond to something like that, like the students having grabbed one of these buses. Now, in that case, it would be, of course, very notorious that if a drug shipment had been accidentally grabbed, unknowingly grabbed by the students inside one of these buses, that the people called to rescue the drugs were not so-called narcos, right? But the police, and not just any old, perhaps, you know, corrupt cop, but no, all of the police in the entire area from the three levels of government and with the Army looking on. That all said, I think that regardless of the initial spark, the initial motivation for attacking the students, simultaneously the character of violence, the intensity of the brutality against the students, this combination of armed attack, murder, mutilation, and forced disappearance is itself very much a political violence targeted at the students for being who they are, for being students from rural and often indigenous communities in some of the most economically battered regions of the country, who not only dare to study, but dare to be intensely vocal and politically active.
Well, John Gibler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian. I really appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with John Gibler, who's the author of I Couldn't Even Imagine That They Would Kill Us, an oral history of the attacks against the students at Ayotzinapa. Mexico Unconquered, Chronicles of Power and Revolt, and To Die in Mexico, Dispatches from Inside the Drug War. His work on the 43 missing students from the Ayotzinapa Rural Teachers College has been published in California Sunday Magazine, featured on All Things Considered and praised by The New Yorker, and his latest book, Torn from the World, A Story of Forced Disappearance in Mexico, will be released this July. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into a major strategic blunder underway with Secretary of State Pompeo making a deal with Turkey to sell out the Kurds over the objection of Secretary of Defense Mattis.
¿Cuánto tiempo va a pasar para que pueda mejorar? Todos somos víctimas de un estado confiscado, con un gobierno involucrado en las ganancias del narco. Es una nación podrida con la población herida. México, 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 México.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University, and a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, whose latest book is An Uncertain Ally: Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you, Ian.
And you're bringing to light this deal that was made between U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Turkey's foreign minister that basically looks like a yet another sellout of the Kurds, that the U.S. is going to – or that the Kurds are going to be withdrawn from this enclave of is it called Manjib?
Manbij
in northern Syria. And you're characterizing it as a strategic blunder. We've known that previously President Trump talked about unilaterally pulling out of this key area where there's a small contingent of U.S. special forces and Kurdish fighters astride what would be a land route between Tehran and Damascus, also occupying the oil fields, which they liberated from the Islamic State, which are coveted by the Assad regime. So we've already had indications of some peculiar impulse on the part of President Trump to sort of abandon U.S. gains and a major U.S. bargaining chip at a time when the Islamic State is not really finished off in any case. So what's happening now with this particular withdrawal from Manbij?
The Kurds in Syria have been absolutely betrayed by the United States. At our behest, they served as America's boots on the ground to attack and occupy the ISIS caliphate, so-called, in Raqqa. 650 members of the Kurdish militia, the People's Protection Forces, died in Raqqa. Manbij is a training center where U.S. Special Forces have been providing training and weapons to the YPG, to the Syrian Kurds. Erdogan calls them a terrorist organization and has demanded that the U.S. evacuate and give Manbij to Turkey. Turkey's forces are the Free Syrian Army, who are Salafists and jihadists who have committed terrible atrocities. They are essentially an extension of ISIS. So not only have we betrayed the Kurds in Syria, we've also given back hard-fought territory from the Islamic State to a jihadist group that Turkey controls. The whole thing makes no strategic sense. It's also dead wrong to ask people to fight and die for you and then throw them under the bus.
But why is this deal being done? Obviously, it's some kind of concession to Turkey. And I don't understand what that could be, because with Donald Trump's private business getting in the way of so much in terms of geopolitics, with his son-in-law getting money from Qatar after they were blockaded, and it looks as if the blockade was ended in order to get this money, with hotel deals inside of Turkey itself, with cronies of Erdogan. I'm looking around for a rationale. We've never had to think about our foreign policy in terms of a president having these kind of conflicts. But because it doesn't make a lot of sense, that's why I'm sort of fishing around for a strategic rationale.
So there are rumors of Trump Organization business interests in Turkey. The decision on Manbij is also taken by the White House against the advice of the U.S. Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, who knows that the fight against ISIS isn't finished and that we need the Syrian Kurds, the YPG, to continue the fight and finish the job. There's also a Russian factor in all of this. Turkey has been feigning ties to Russia. It announced the purchase of S-400 surface-to-air missiles at a cost of $2.5 billion. This violates one of the core NATO principles, the interoperability of weapon systems by members of the alliance. Turkey's also joined with Russia and Iran in something called the Astana process, to end the war in Syria. In fact, it simply sustained the war, and the UN-led mediation that the U.S. supports has been relegated to the back bench, and the U.S. is absolutely excluded from any of the meetings in Astana. So the whole thing is perplexing. Why are we acting against our national interests? Why are we allowing jihadists to take back territory that the U.S. and the Syrian Kurds fought hard to liberate? And why are we allowing Iran now to own this corridor from Iran through Baghdad to Damascus and Beirut, through which it ships missiles and weapons to Hamas and Hezbollah? Trump's foreign policy is incoherent. It lacks strategic orientation, and it's inexplicable, particularly since we've been fighting ISIS for the past 2 years and are on the verge of fully and finally defeating the terrorist group.
But presumably we're going ahead with this. The Kurds have got to feel deeply betrayed. The Islamic State people are slipping into Turkey and going in onto Europe, where they'll create mayhem. So on at that level, it's inconceivable. And then you've got this small American force there that was able to stop an incursion from Russian mercenaries and Assad to try and seize the oil fields. Mercenaries were promised booty if they could grab the oil fields, and of course the U.S. wiped them out. So you can see what the military are doing there and why Mattis is taking this position, but nothing that Trump's doing makes any sense, and that's why I just wonder, in the broader landscape, it's so easy to make deals with Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin. They're pariahs. They desperately want to be acknowledged. They're kleptocrats. They run criminal families that are, or cronies are running these countries. And North Korea is the worst totalitarian state on the planet with the worst human rights record. Of course you can make a deal with this guy. We've already elevated him on the world stage. So he's already won, and we got nothing in return. And if Trump has his summit with Putin that he's planning, the same will happen. At the same time, you're dissing your allies and declaring a trade war on them. So at the broadest level, none of this makes any sense. And now what you're revealing is what's happening on the ground in the longest fight the U.S. has had for the longest time, except for Afghanistan. And suddenly we're just walking away, snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. Or should I say it the other way around? Snatching victory from the jaws of defeat. Or, no. Which is it? The first one. You got me confused. The first one.
In this incoherent Trump world, we can't tell the difference.
Right. Well,
but let me clarify one thing you said, Ian. You talked about that they were going through Turkey to Europe. They're going back to Turkey. That's where all these jihadists came from. Turkey engineered the creation of ISIS in Syria by facilitating the passage of international fighters from Sanliurfa to Raqqa beginning in 2012, giving them weapons, giving them money, providing them logistics, even health care when they were wounded in Turkish hospitals. Joe Biden said at a speech in Harvard the following year that Erdogan told him that they let too many jihadists through Turkey. So there's somehow this false notion that Turkey is a member of the coalition fighting ISIS. Turkey is an active conspirator with ISIS. Its fighters in Syria today, the Free Syrian Army, is another incarnation of these jihadist forces. And the idea that Turkey is a valued NATO ally is completely based on a false understanding. Turkey's buying weapons from Russia, it's cozying diplomatically with Russia, it's supported jihadists and is continuing to do so. The only friends and allies the U.S. has in Syria are the Syrian Kurds. Our only combatants that we were able to cooperate effectively with in killing ISIS is the YPG. So why have we announced this bogus deal to sell out the YPG, give their headquarters to Turkey, evict them to the eastern side of the Euphrates River, and give Turkey a free rein on the Turkish-Syrian border? The whole thing is incomprehensible. It's strategically incoherent, and it lacks moral consistency. which I'm afraid to say is a hallmark of Trump's foreign policy worldwide.
Well, we know he's ignorant, and we know he's totally transactional, and we know that the lines between national security and personal enrichment for Trump and his family have been crossed in the most flagrant ways. So that's a given. But I get back to the broader question of whether or not Trump and his cabinet are empowering the worst people on this planet and giving a breath of fresh air to autocrats at the expense of frail democracies under a siege around the world, and whether in this case, since Pompeo was the executioner, it would indicate to me that Pompeo is not an independent player. He's supposed to be an adult. He's supposed to be highly intelligent, West Point grad and all that stuff. It sounds like he's just taking his orders from Trump and doing what the boss wants. And that bodes very ill for this meeting in Singapore with Kim Jong-un, because that's completely cosmetic, makes no sense at all. We're getting nothing out of it, but Trump's getting a photo op, which is all he wants and which is all he understands, frankly. And Pompeo is going to sell us out. We know Trump will sell us out, but where's the adults? And if Mattis has already been rolled, then we're truly screwed.
So Trump is interested in the optics. In Mombich, he's made a deal with Turkey. You know, I call Turkey, Russia, and Iran the new axis of evil. For some reason, the Trump administration seems to be prepared to roll over and cooperate with these countries in some respect. It bodes ill for serious diplomacy when the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, is sidelined, and we face a daunting challenge like North Korea's nuclear program. There is no adult in the room. There's only a propagandist and a narcissist in the form of the president who knows nothing about foreign policy and keeps making deals that sell out America's interests. Cause for serious concern.
Well, David Phillips, I have to leave you on that depressing note. I can't dispute what you're saying. I'm in shock. Every day I'm in more further shock. And now here in California, you know, we thought there was going to be a blue wave and the damn Democrats didn't even show up in numbers. So it looks as if Trump is going to get away with not just domestic wreckage, but international wreckage as well.
And where is the outrage about what's happening in the United States and America's diminished prestige around the world? You know, we need to be deeply concerned, and we need to take action. And the way we can do that is by voting and demonstrating our displeasure with the policies that the administration is pursuing.
Well, David Phillips, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peacebuilding and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, whose latest book is An Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Lariva Latt. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.